This episode of the Sober Curious podcast is supported by Athletic Brewing alcohol-free craft beers, and you can get 20% off your first order at athleticbrewing.com with the code RUBY20. So as we move out of the pandemic, yay, I'm hearing a lot of Sober Curious folks feeling the pressure to socialise again. And for anybody who's ready to join the summer fun but without the hangover, Athletic have a brew for you. Crafted in state-of-the-art breweries in Connecticut and California, their mission is to provide beers that are packed with all the flavour and none of the alcohol. The result is a line of delicious, refreshing beers starting at just 50 calories a can, making them the perfect addition to any healthy lifestyle. Athletic beers are in stores nationwide and they also ship online. Place an order today at athleticbrewing.com and get free shipping on 2 6-packs or more. And remember, new customers can also get 20% off their entire order with the code RUBY20. That's limited to one use per customer at athleticbrewing.com. Welcome back to the Sober Curious podcast, a place for conversations about living a more conscious and connected life. I'm your host, Ruby Warrington, and my guest this week is Samantha Moyo, an activist, artist, and creative expansion coach. I asked Sam on the podcast because she is also the original founder of Morning Gloryville, which was the first sober morning dance party when it launched back in 2013. Sam shares the origin story of what became a movement that helped millions of people all around the world find joy on the dance floor without alcohol. Since she moved on from that role, she's been pretty involved in the activism scene and has also worked with all sorts of organizations, teams, and individuals to help bring the humanity and the creativity back into what they do. For me, Sam is the definition of a free spirit, and our conversation goes to some pretty wild and out there places. I encourage you to keep an open mind and heart while listening. I should also include a trigger warning, as about halfway through our interview, Sam shares why she decided to start drinking again after her years as a figurehead for sobriety. There's also plenty of sex and spiritual rock and roll sprinkled throughout the interview, so it's probably not one to listen to with your grandma. This is Samantha Moyo. Sam, hi, how are you?
I am always better for speaking to you. You are like a bit of a light in my journey. So I'm really good. I'm really good. How are you?
The same. I've been having a bit of an anxiety day, and then I was like, oh, I'm speaking to Sam. I've got an hour with Sam. That'll be nice.
Yeah.
There aren't many people actually that I would want to get on and do a podcast with when I've been kind of in a bit of an anxiety moment. You know, normally that's the time when I'd be like, actually something came up. Can we reschedule? But with you today, I was just like, yeah, Sam, there's something about your vibe that kind of always makes me feel a bit calmer. And a bit better about the world. So thanks, Sam, for being you.
Well, you give me the same as well. I've got a bit of grief in my heart that I think we're all sort of purging at the moment. And at the end of the day, it's like 6 p.m. after looking at a screen, all I want to do is jump in a river. But actually, I was like, I can show up to Ruby and her community like this, you know? So, yeah,
Thank you. It's nice
to be real and to hold these spaces for each other.
We can jump in a metaphorical river together with our conversation, maybe. So, Sam, love fest aside, I'm really excited to have you on the Sober Curious podcast. I feel like, Sam, you were the original Sober Curious influencer. Before there were Sober Curious influencers, you were out there spreading the word about how fun it can be to socialize without alcohol, how fabulous we can be without substances, because you were one of the founders or the founder of Morning Gloryville, which was a early morning rave dance party, alcohol-free, that happened in London. And when did you launch that? I feel like it was like way back before anyone was talking about this stuff.
Way back in the day. It was in 2013 that we launched, May 2013. And I think, so it started in London, and like a year later, we were in 23 cities around the world. Because once people had tried it, sober raving, dancing in the morning, it just became a little bit like, why haven't we been doing this? But I'll just rewind to how that came about. Have I told you actually about how Morning Gloryville came about?
No, I've never heard the origin story, which is why, like, yeah, I was so excited to have you on and actually hear all about it.
Yeah. So I was known in my previous life as Captain Hello Titties. And Captain Hello Titties used to put on these wild, amazing underground boat parties that would be just one evening, but would last for days after. And you can imagine what Captain Hello Titties got up to. I think a lot of us have been there. Good times, no regrets, but it just became highly unsustainable. But I do miss those days after lockdown. Have to be honest. A friend of mine were just like, okay, we can't keep partying like this. How are we going to stop? Tried AA, didn't work. It was just so boring. It made me want to drink more, actually. No offense to other AA people out there. So tried AA, not my thing. Went to Five Rhythms, felt like it was a bit too Om Shanti and spiritual, and I just felt like I couldn't get with that groove, you know.
Unfamiliar, Five Rhythms is like a sort of dancing meditation thing that happens to music. It's like silent dancing for 2 hours. Sam was just doing the visuals on my camera. You didn't see it, but it's very swishy and swirly.
Yeah. It's very like deep breathing and like really feeling into yourself. I did Five Rhythms and it just wasn't quite it. And then meditation, I mean, I was just starting out meditation, so I wasn't getting the enlightenment that everyone was talking about. So me and my friend at the time were like, why don't we start a sober morning party? And it has to be, it was like, it had to be at 6 a.m. on a Wednesday morning, because that was the only ourselves not to wake up and take drugs. Monday and Tuesday you're hungover, Thursday you're ready to party again for the weekend. We were just like, yeah, morning glory, we're just gonna, you know, start our day like feeling good and just fake it till we make it. Luckily, 26 people came in to a 700 capacity club, lost loads of money. But you know what? The people who came were just like, whoa, touched, mesmerized. We were all just experiencing. Well, first we'd just woken up, gone to a club before going to work and listened to amazing music, dressed really well and like just had eye contact and hugs, you know. And we were all so touched by the morning that I think everyone must have told at least 50 other people that by the next event, it was like 400 people. The next event, it was selling out. BBC came and then it went viral. It was just one of those really quick situations, you know. Yeah. So that's really how Morning Gloryville came about. And I think for me, on my journey, I was so desperate for years leading up to it. Like, I remember every New Year's Day being really hungover and just being like, dear God, you know, please help me, you know, live a healthier life, or like help me stop drinking. I just wanted to be happier, you know. And it was like nothing shifted. But when Morning Gloryville started, honestly, it was just like having this space that was a practice, a place you could go to practice being you, the fun, open-hearted, expressive you that you are, without alcohol available, just made it easier to be like, we can do this. And I think as a community, like, because a lot of my friends are burners, like we're all burners and all of that. As a community, I saw so many people start sobering up really fast. But it was because we realized we could be our colorful, wild, flamboyant, off the cuff selves without, like sober as well. Like we didn't have to blame being rude or ridiculous or whatever on, oh, I was drunk. You know, it was like, this is me. And we're going to accept each other as we are, you know? So, and I think dance does that to people. Dance is one way, one thing that really just shuts everyone up, you know? If you're thinking too much and you start dancing, it's just like God or someone out there just says, shut up. No, like, just shut up.
It's so true, which is why I've, in my own sort of dalliances in the sober rave scene or sober dance parties, I've just found it so sad that we as humans have been conditioned to be so kind of disconnected from that kind of sexy, wild dancing self, that we need alcohol to give ourselves permission almost. You touched on it there as well. You were like, why were we using alcohol so that we needed alcohol as an excuse to be these kind of wild, raunchy selves? How about we just remove it and we just accept that that's part of us and that we are that, and that it's okay to express that, you know? And that's that message just is so buried, you know? And it's, oh.
Yeah. I remember having orgasms dancing at Morning Gloryville, like tantric moments with someone dressed as a mermaid, and you know, just being like, oh my God, like massive heartgasm. And you know, it just being allowed. And oddly enough, since I sold it, in fact, as soon as I sold Morning Gloryville, one of my first books that I read for the first time after running a company and you have time to read was Pussy. Do you know that book?
No.
Oh my goodness. It's by the woman who founded the School of Womanly Arts. Mm-hmm. She's based in New York. Her name's Regina someone.
Yeah, I know who you mean. I can't remember her surname, but I know exactly who you mean. Yes.
Good old Regina.
I'll look it up and put it in the show notes.
Yeah. And I just remember reading this book, and it was like the first time I was able to start really articulating my love for eroticism, my love for pleasure, and also starting this journey of what I do now, which is, you know, get people to look at how we do sex is how we do, I mean, how we do sex is how we do business, you know, because I feel like the two are intertwined. And actually it's been helping me massively, just being like, I'm an anxious attachment in relationships. That's my attachment styles. And how does that show up at work as well? Oh, when I put things out, I want instant results. And when I don't get it, I'm like, you know, needy. So I'm sort of now working on my relationships and pleasure, as well as my business in tandem, because they are, everything's interconnected. And I think that's I think the separation of pleasure and business is something that the patriarchy brought in, that I feel like is our job as the feminine to bring it back in again, and not in a madman kind of way, you know, not in a, you know, objectifying kind of way, but in a bring sensuality into work, you know? So
I love it. I want to go deeper with you further on. And I also just now, because I've just been writing about this in my new book, but not only has the pleasure been taken from business, but pleasure has been a business in the whole kind of marriage industrial complex. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of the breakdown of the kind of heteronormative ideas around marriage and 2.4 children, this nuclear family being the kind of ideal, is removing sort of sexuality, or separating sexuality from being a business, basically. Do you know what I mean? That's a little bit of an aside, but.
No, yeah, I totally get what you're saying, because the whole nucleus family, I think it was good for that time. I think people were coming out of war and just needed, you know, simplicity and boundaries and all that. But I think for the time where we are now, it's actually you can be in a relationship, a long-term relationship, but still fancy and be turned on by other people, you know, and that you're allowed to hold that and communicate that now, you know? And there are all kinds of relationship styles now that I feel I've never seen so many different genders and different relationship styles. It's pretty abundant, you know, these days. But there is still, I still notice, maybe because I work in tech environments a lot as well, is that I still notice that the whole pleasure and sensuality is slightly removed from business. It's almost like, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's almost like, some things, like, I don't know, it's like, everyone's still a little bit scared and tentative, maybe because of the laws.
But also because of Me Too. I think that, you know, people are very scared. And and I think what you're talking about is not like, hey, let's everybody in the office be like getting off with each other. Your work and what you're describing reminds me a lot of, and I had this as a question later on, because I've just been reading this book, Pleasure Activism by Adrienne Murray Brown, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And she talks about Audre Lorde's kind of definition of the erotic being this kind of, this feeling inside of us, which is pure joy, pleasure, satiation. It's like pure kind of fulfillment and satisfaction. And that's the erotic. And once we've experienced that and allowed ourselves to experience that sexually, then we can pursue that same feeling of fulfillment and satisfaction and joy and pleasure and just yes in all of our endeavors. And I think that's kind of, what you're describing has just is reminded me of that reading that I've been doing recently.
Yeah, I'm so glad you reminded me of that, because I love Audre Lorde and her work. But one of the meditations I take my clients through at the start of our journeys together is, again, to close their eyes and we imagine Eros, the energy of Eros, the erotic energy coming into the different parts of your body and like really feeling that sensuality, like in your feet, in your legs, in your thighs, you know? And it's always like, they're always like, why don't I do this? Why haven't I done this? Because it's really simple actually. And it isn't like massive, you know, it's not massively taboo kind of thing. It's actually quite innocent, you know, eroticism and Eros in its purity and what it's here to do. It's our creative energy, it's our inspiration, it's our like joie de vivre, it's our like cheekiness, you know. There's so much, I feel like there's so many things in that quality, you know.
A lot of which comes out on dance floors. That's like, that is somewhere like a sanctioned place for us to express that outside of sexual relationships and sexual encounters. Right? But dance floors are always awash with alcohol. So it's like we're allowed to experience so long as we're not fully aware of it in a way. You know, it's almost like going back to that thing about using the alcohol as a way to give ourselves permission or like blame it on the booze, you know, which is still a disavowal. It's like a disavowal of that kind of energy in us, which I think we still have. There's so much shame around the erotic and around our sort of sexual expression. So much shame that's just been layered on over the centuries, you know.
Really, it's so funny when I think about where a lot of the world is and where I am, because like this year I really got into intimacy with trees, tree humping. And I've actually been on a few dates where, you know, I've been like, oh, you know, I've been really enjoying intimacy with trees, and someone's been like, me too. And then we're like talking about like, oh my God, you've been doing that as well. Like, I wonder if other people listening right now, if anyone has secretly, you know, gone up to a tree and sort of, you know, with consent, of course, had their way with it, you know. It is tantric. It's not like, you know, you're not like naked, rubbing yourself on the tree. It's more of a tantric connection. But I feel like we are in this space because of the consciousness movement and people becoming sober, more and more people becoming sober, where we're becoming really sensitive and are realizing that like pleasure isn't just from people, pleasure isn't just with self, like pleasure is with our reading, with our books, with the things we touch, with nature, you know, with the ocean, you know. And I think Yeah, I guess I'm talking about this more to invite people to like just stretch ourselves a little bit. Like, you know, it's post-pandemic, we've just made it through this like historical epic journey. Like, what do you have to lose? Like where are you getting your pleasure and where could you expand your capacity for it? Like, you know, yeah, I think I just want to invite people to sort of not just in dance floors, but in nature, like in reading and just day-to-day lives, just like, oh, I don't know, just feel an experience like sensuality and just invite that eros in. Because when I do it, I just feel like, I just feel stronger and more empowered. And I feel it's something that's in Africa a lot, you know, like, people are really much more comfortable in their sexuality, and it doesn't have a sort of like look at me sort of way. It just creates a more empowered culture, you know, like, I don't know, you know? So yeah, anyway, so yeah, I just, yeah, that's all I have to say about that. Yeah. I have more,
a,
I guess
a
I got
beautiful invitation. Yeah, why?
Yeah.
What happened? What interrupted the flow of the river there?
Well, I just got a little bit insecure because, like, I can't see everyone I'm talking to, and I know that I'm quite far down the line of unapologetic living. Like, I wake up and I go howling. I hump trees. I do. BDSM with trees as well, you know, so like I guess a part of me feels a little bit vulnerable sharing, but also not wanting to scare people away, you know, in this sensitive time. So that's
it is a sensitive time, and everything you've been sharing has been with love, and I'm sure that people listening will receive it that way. And I think, you know, I think you gave this caveat earlier, like, even when you were talking about AA, for example, you went to AA, you found it wasn't for you. And that came with the, and of course, for anybody that works for, then great. And I think let's just pause in the recording at this point and say, and that applies to everything you've been saying, right? It's like, we all have our unique ways of interacting with the world, interacting with our bodies, following our desire, et cetera, et cetera. And you describing what works for you isn't by no means you telling everybody else they should be living that way. And by the same token, anybody listening has no right to, you know, tell you shouldn't be living that way. You know, you're not hurting anybody. If anything, like I said, everything you've been describing has been coming from a place of real love and passion and joy. And I think we'd all agree that we need more of that in the world.
So, tree humping.
I don't know. I hope that makes you feel more comfortable.
Yeah. Thank you. That was really lovely to hear. And actually, as you're reflecting back, I just realized how in that moment I'd sort of fallen slightly victim of like all the world issues that have happened. And there's so much sensitivity out there that I feel sometimes like I can't say everything. And that's why I started this mission on unapologetic living, was because I just felt like it wasn't just me. It was like loads of us who are quite confident people, were starting to be a bit more like shy and, oh, should I say that? Or like, you know, over trying to be PC, politically correct. And, you know, I'm Black, I'm queer, and I'm so many boxes, you know, and sometimes I'm not sure if I'm, you know, if I'm saying the right thing about stuff. So I think part of this mission of like, okay, what can we do with our bodies to just break free a little bit has been to transcend what I feel has become a little bit of a glass ceiling above my head, you know? And yeah, you know, I was asked to do some work for like lesbian visibility. And I was like, I don't know if I'm a lesbian. Do I still count? because I'm now gender fluid. And actually I've realized that I love women, but I want to be with a man and a woman now, you know? So do I still, am I still allowed in that group? You know, things move so fast, and I feel like we change so fast these days because we are doing much more inner work. We are, a lot of us are becoming fluid, like super fluid, and not just the way we think, the way we live, like who we fancy, you know, the way we love. So yeah, so a lot of this unapologetic living thing is about like giving myself the freedom to be a chameleon, to change, and like also ask that, you know, as a community, as a global community, we give each other that freedom. Like, you know, you might be Ruby today, tomorrow you might be Dave, man, like who knows, like I'm okay with that, Ruby, you know. And on that note, I've inspired so many people to sober up, like so many people. Morning Glory inspired millions, like that's crazy. And I'm really proud of that. And I have a massive confession. I now love drinking. I love having, and it's not in the same way at all. Mm. I just love having a glass of red wine now and again. And I love that I can do that and I don't get carried away.
I wanted to hear about this sort of this transition. I want to just slow down a little bit because I really want to get into the kind of like the like picking up like having a drink again and doing it differently, because I think that's something that a lot of people come to the Sober Curious conversation with a desire for. You know, I want to change my drinking. I don't know if I want to give it up completely. In my experience, it meant giving it up completely for a long, long period of time to really break the habit and to really get underneath what was driving the habit as well. And only when I'd done that kind of deeper healing work did I know that I had severed that, you know, problematic behavior, or like I'd changed that problematic behavior and it wasn't going to come back. But I want to speak to you a bit more about the, since we were on the tip of the unapologetic living.
You're my soul sister. Sorry. You're my soul sister. Everything you're saying, I agree with. Cool.
Okay. On the unapologetic, when you first started talking about the unapologetic living, first of all, it just seemed like it was so you, because you are so expressed. And it's really beautiful to see you get vulnerable then, because you've always been someone I've just thought, wow, she just really doesn't give a shit. She's just like so her, and that's so wonderful and inspiring. But it's actually really sweet to see that you too feel vulnerability around that, as we all do, right? As we all do. So tell me a bit more about unapologetic living and what it actually means. And because I'm really happy that you brought up the whole thing about like cancel culture, because that was a question. I was like, because I was thinking, as a cisgendered white woman, I sort of feel like the wider culture is telling me I have some apologizing to do. And so for me to be out there living unapologetically doesn't feel, I don't know, but I was also really intrigued by, oh, but wait, there's a difference between being consciously aware of my privilege and of some of the ways that that might have contributed to harm, and sort of making myself small and not speaking up anymore and feeling like I have to apologize for everything. They're like two totally different things, but I think they have got really confused in the culture. Like you say, a lot of people who are kind of just coming into a greater awareness about what's been going on and the different systems of oppression that we're all sort of, you know, participating and complicit in some way. And sort of feeling like, okay, that means I just need to make myself small and disappear, when actually that's not really helping anyone. So yeah, I'm really happy you brought that piece up. And I'd love to just hear a bit more about your sort of manifesto for unapologetic living with conscious awareness of like the world that we're living in and the problems that we're kind of grappling together.
I think what I realized, because I did so much decolonization work, all my career has been about encouraging people to self-express, you know, to be their real authentic selves. You know, that's what, you know, unapologetic living is about. What I realized, and the reason I had to take a break, was from doing anti-racism work and like doing this TED talk that kind of went semi-viral and all this, I just realized that actually my awareness, I was becoming over-aware. I was getting over-aware of microaggressions. I was getting over-aware of everything. And it just changed my lens and how I saw people. it meant that actually I saw a lot of my white friends as not nice people. Like I just assumed the worst of the world because I just knew too much and it was like in my body. And I did notice it just inhibit, like hold back the like Sam, the expressive, playful, joyful Sam. And it was like, you know, and that's why I moved to the countryside, to Devon during lockdown. I was like, I don't want to be locked down in the, you know, in a flat in London. I'm not happy. This is not cool. And I moved here and I, you know, 2 weeks later, I was like, oh my God, this is so much better. Best decision, you know, best decision ever. And I felt ashamed to share. It was like, I felt scared to share that I was happier. I was scared to share my photos. And then I just started questioning what's happened. What's happened to me? What's been going on? And I just realized that I just wasn't, I was just being apologetic. I was just saying sorry. I was being British. I was just taking everything that was going on with the world onto my shoulders when I'm actually someone who was born in Zimbabwe, you know, until I was 15. I already had to do so much work when I initially moved here in order to become a free spirit, in order to start a movement, you know? So I was just like, no. So I said no to participating in anything that had to do with identity. I was just like, I can't do it anymore. I just wanna see myself as a soul. Like, even though I don't see it right now, I just wanna experience myself as a soul. And then a big part of that was like, okay, in terms of the practices I do, I was like, I need to find my own practices that are just mine. Like none of this yoga meditation thing, because that shit's not touching the side when I'm, you know, kind of going downhill because of locked pandemic grief, you know? So I was like, okay, I'm just gonna make up my own flows. And so I started coming up with my own practices and I started dance jogging instead of just, you know, jogging or dancing, like neither of them, I wanted to do them at the same time. So that's what I would do, you know? I started the howling, which is actually my favorite practice now, you know? Waking up and just being like, oh, you know, I started, yeah, obviously, I mean, everyone has been walking, we've all walked more than ever. I've talked about the tree humping, cold water swimming. But really, it was just like, I just need to do things that are my primal self wants to do. And I think that's at the core of living unapologetically. It's like connecting with your primal self. Like, imagine no one showed you anything, you know, no one showed you anything, no one told you something. What does your body want to do? How does your voice want to express? How do you want to breathe? How do you want to make love to yourself? Like, you know, and it's just really just having the courage to do those things and not judge ourselves. That's mm-hmm. been the hardest part, not judging myself and mm-hmm. posting it and being like, oh God, now everyone's really going to think I've lost the plot. Oh, I probably have lost the plot, but actually I feel better. I feel happier, sexier, more girls fancy me actually. So,
amazing.
You know, I'm willing.
But what you're describing, like when you started Morning Gloryville, there might have been plenty of people who were like, you've lost the plot. Like, how could we go and get dressed up and dance on a Wednesday morning at 6 a.m. without alcohol? Like what the fuck, do you know what I mean? And then it kind of spawned this global movement, and like you said, helped millions of people address their drinking and find joy as non-drinkers. So like, I don't know, I feel like you're such an outlier, you're so far ahead of the pack, and being similar, like I followed a similar path in many ways, that comes with a lot of uncertainty and doubt in the beginning as to like, is everyone just going to think this is like completely weird? Am I completely weird? Like, what the hell? And there's a bit of a leap of faith into just kind of, well, I'm just going to have to do this because it's just sort of happening. And here we go.
Yeah. It's funny with my work. I always feel like my work triggers me a little bit. Like there is a lot of doubt when I'm doing it. because there's no camaraderie in it. And the way the messages come is actually because I'm really sensitive. I'm hypersensitive. So spirit literally tells me to do something and I'll ignore it because I'll be like, no, that's crazy. And then I'll just keep getting the same message. And it's like, I have to do it because if I don't do it, then I'm not, my body's not well. So then suddenly I'm expressing and doing these things and putting these things out. But it's awfully lonely because I'm like, can anyone validate it? But what I've realized is that's not what's going to happen with me and my path. And when I started Morning Gloryville, you know, that's confirmation enough. I knew lots of people, 26 people only turned up, you know, right, to the first one. And my family did think I was, you know, they were just like, what are you doing? Basically, you know, so... and I see you do that work, and I think that's why I feel really comfortable and always look forward to our chats, because it's like, you get it, babe. I see you, you see me, you know. So,
and that intense sensitivity that you describe as well is definitely something I can relate to, and it's definitely one of the big reasons I used alcohol, because I think that it's just so intense. It's very intense for me being around a lot of people. I can completely understand why being in nature. So our latest Numinous Books release is called Venus Juice. I think you would absolutely love it, actually. And there's a quote that I pulled out to go on the Numinous Instagram. And it was like, being in nature is a relief because you don't have to be anyone or be anything. It's like the trees aren't going to judge you for howling at the moon, you know. It's like the trees don't give a shit how many Instagram followers you've got. It's like it's just such a relief to be surrounded by living beings that don't give a shit about who you are or what you do or what you look like or any of that stuff, you know. So yeah, I'm wondering if you, when you started using alcohol, was it about, because it confusingly felt to me at the time like I was just kind of enhancing myself. It felt like, wow, I've released a part of myself that's so expressed and is so like confident that I maybe haven't been able to access before, that had maybe been kind of like buried under multiple sort of traumas. And it felt like it was helping me to express myself. But actually, in that slippery way that alcohol does, it was actually simply masking the stuff which I needed to deal with, which was what was actually preventing me to from expressing myself properly. Does that like when you started using alcohol, what was the appeal for you?
I mean, it just was cool to drink in the 90s, babe. Like, come on. It was like, come, you know, like it was such a rock and roll. The 90s and noughties was such a rock and roll thing. You know, there wasn't any of this yoga. We had Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love. Like, that was the culture. You wanted to like smoking, drinking, puking your guts up. That was like cool, radical. It was cool. Yeah. You got social points, you know. So I think that's where it really started. It was just like, this is the cool thing to do. I'm a cool kid. I'm doing it. It was only when I was at uni that I realized why I was doing it, because things started surfacing and I was then consciously taking things to suppress the emotions. And actually, if I didn't have Morning Gloryville and that busyness, I don't think it would have been wise for me to stop drinking. Trauma that my body has had, you know, which I don't really talk about. And so for me personally, it was really, I feel so blessed now that I had this business that was growing as a sort of container for me to stop, as well as a community to hold me in my stopping. And then actually it was after I sold the business and had 5 years experience that I was able to then start dealing with the shit.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It was like, that's when I was like, okay, shit, I've been suppressing rape and violence and like so many things from my childhood. And I've just been holding it down my whole life. And it's now time to address it. And I think sometimes we don't realize what our body's been holding on to. But also sometimes our bodies and us aren't ready to process that stuff. Because there's a lot around feeling and feeling, you know, really getting with our emotions and going in and everything. But I actually don't think that's always good. Like, if you've experienced a lot, I think we need to resource ourselves, you know? And so often when, you know, because people still phone me and say, I want to stop drinking, what should I do? I'm like, resource yourself. You know, if you're going to stop drinking, find a new group of friends, start doing new activities, you know, because stuff's going to start coming up and we all have stuff, you know? So you want to be held in it. And also, like, I think when people do the cut it too fast, that's really hard. It's so hard on the nervous system, like going cold turkey without resourcing yourself with nature, with love, with music, with, you know, with touch, you know? So these are the things I just like realized that when I was starting to deal with my shit on my own, I needed to start bringing into my life.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And that's why now I feel like I've got quite, feel like I'm balancing out a little bit, maturing, integrating, able to hold more, and now able to have a drink.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, yes, now, as you just, you know, as we sort of touched on earlier, it's like, it's one thing. I think once you've really, really dealt with your shit, like really, like you say, resourced yourself, have really given yourself the time, the support, the practices, the time, I'll say that again, the time to really process whatever might be underneath your drinking, because there's invariably some, if drinking is problematic, there's invariably something underneath the drinking. I don't think, I wonder if it would be possible to even go back to problematic drinking if you've really done your healing work, actually. Because if I have a drink now, there's no way I would ever want to drink more than half a glass of wine, because I don't like the feeling of it anymore. I don't like the feeling of numbness. I don't like, all I feel when I drink now is just kind of numb and slightly removed from the world. And I don't I don't need to feel that way anymore, because I've looked at all of the stuff that's kind of, that was underneath my problematic drinking.
Yeah, I think I know, and I looked at stuff that was underneath the problematic drinking, but I think new stuff has cropped up.
Right. Okay, yes. That makes sense too.
I think there's new stuff because, like, to be honest, it was like during lockdown three, and one of my friends was like, do you know what, Sam, you've done so much work, you're doing all this, etc., just maybe you should just let yourself have a drink sometimes, you know? And then I was like, okay, I'll do that. And so she was like, just make it ritualistic. And I know this isn't a sober curious thing, but I do want to share it. And I did, and it just felt so good to just have a bit of respite during lockdown, living on my own, and just like, you know, just have a glass and a half and feel a little bit tipsy and just be like with my friend and just like be like, oh, this is actually pretty, like the escapism was needed, because like I didn't know how much more in I needed to go and how much more work I needed to do. It was like, you know, one of the things at the moment, I'm like, I don't want like loads of spiritual conscious friends around me, because I don't want like lots long eye gazes and 5 minute hugs and like really deep conversations. I don't want to process. I work in personal development. Like, I want shallow chats, you know. I want like what we having for dinner, should we go play ball at the beach, like that's where I'm at now. I'm just like, and I come back to this, you know, I learned this from somatic experiencing. It's like resourcing. It's like we do the inner work, we go in, we make some changes, we make some shifts, and then shift in, like go into something else. Because if you keep on going in and in, it becomes toxic. And I think that's why the wellness industry, sometimes it's like puke, you know, it's like, get it away from me. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So that's the dance I've been in now with sobriety, wellness, and alcohol. It's like, I feel happy that I can have a drink and not get completely wasted. I love that I can then go to a yoga class and do, you know, I don't think there's one way to live. And I think this is another thing with unapologetic. It's like bringing our whole selves to the party, bringing our whole selves to life, you know? Because there's something when we suppress our edges as well, you know, that's no, you know?
Yes, thank you for describing all of that. And I think a lot of people will be able to relate to it. I actually did a podcast for this with this woman in Australia. She was interviewing me about it's all about anxiety. But anyway, I was saying to her that I feel like I've got to a place with alcohol where it's not something I ever think about. And it's not something I'd ever kind of have a craving for. But I have almost got it in my toolkit as like a have a brandy after a shock. You know, because the one time I had a drink last year was in the middle of the Black Lives Matter uprising after the George Floyd incident, and everything was just so fucking heightened and tense. I see. I remember at that time I was walking around, I just kept feeling that my hand was just clenched in a fist. I kept having to kind of like unclench it and be like, and massage my hand because I was just holding so much tension, right? Yeah. And that was the one time last year I had a glass of wine, and it did have the effect of just like, just a kind of out breath in that moment. And I didn't want one again, but it felt like that kind of brandy after a shock. The real true meaning of like a medicinal drink is kind of what it felt like to me, which is slightly different from what you're describing. And maybe it's because I'm such a figurehead of the Sober Curious movement. I kind of feel like there's additional accountability for me to be like, you know, more on the kind of straight up sober tip. And I'm completely fine with that. Yeah. But thanks for your honesty and for sharing that. I think it presents a really, really balanced viewpoint, which is the whole point of this conversation, not just this conversation between you and me, but like the sober curious conversation. It's not about saying like, this is the right way and this is the wrong way. It's about really, truly knowing what's right for you, you know?
Yeah. And when I was running Morning Gloryville, there's no way I would have been getting pissed like or drinking, because I was accountable. So I think we all have to take it in turns to sort of, you know, hold the torch and inspire people and show people that it's possible. And I also think when the time feels right for you to have a drink, you know, that you'll feel that that's okay as well. You know, that's what happened with me. I was suddenly like, oh, I'm not accountable to loads of people on this one thing. So therefore, you know, I can
shuffle the card deck.
Exactly. I was like, I was in Thailand. I was like, I'm on holiday for the first time. Oh my God, I'm going to have a cocktail. It was such a thing. I was like, I'm having a cocktail in a pool. I haven't done this in years, you know? Everything in moderation and like not being too hard on ourselves. And that's really all I have to say to the sober community is like, have fun, be true. Just have fun, be true, and take it easy. Like I went through an activism phase with sobriety, and I think it was needed for me. But I feel so much better not being like proper, like about it all, you know?
You mean you felt like you were a sober activist, like you were an activist for sobriety? Or do you mean that your activism phase coincided with you being a sober person?
Or both? Well, I was both, really. I used to think alcohol was bad, but it wasn't that alcohol was bad. It was that my relationship with alcohol wasn't, you know, wasn't good. Yeah. It was that I didn't know how to have one drink every few months, you know, because I hadn't done the inner work, and because I hadn't learned how to live unapologetically sober, which I can do now.
Right. Exactly. I think that's even in the first Sober Curious book. It's like, if we make alcohol evil, it's still on this pedestal. Like, it still has kind of sort of control over us in a way, you know. Alcohol just is. It's just like one of many things in the world, you know, that we can interact with, but it's our relationship with it, which also about our relationship with ourselves, you know, that we need to look at. And that's what, that's kind of the root of like what AA is about. I loved when you were describing like AA didn't work, so I created this like really far out wild party that also gave me like accountability and a community and a way to process feelings through my body. And like, you created your own program, and it just happened to look like a nightclub, but it was a day club.
Exactly. And this goes back to this primal listening to what our primal needs and primal instincts are, and not suppressing them, because within, you know, and this is where the pleasure stuff comes in as well, because that's one of, that's like a primal urge, that's a primal feeling that runs through us that we put down. So I think the invitation, like for everyone, again, there's lots of invitations happening today, is, you know, like, what would it be like to live like in a really primal way? Like, what if I didn't have all these societal rules on me of you should be like this, you should be like that? How would you actually live each day? What would you do? What would you do to bring like more air to your lungs? What would you do to be more joyful? What would you do to like exercise? Would you go to the gym? Is that really what you would do? You know, like, how would you make love to your lover? Like, are you in a pattern? Is that, you know, is there certain thinking and thoughts coming through that you're like stuck in? Like, is there something else in you that just wants to come out that you're just like not letting out, you know? Because if so, like, I feel like this is like post World War kind of time, where I think now, like, I feel this like just like energy that's just like, we can be whatever we want, because like, we can say we've lived through this like really tough time. Right now is just like, why am I holding back? Like, I don't want to be called Sam anymore. I want to be called Steve, or like, I want to, do you know what I mean? It's like just really allow it. Like, and thankfully, because of all the identity, you know, politics and all of that, we actually have a lot to be like, I can do that. We have a lot of permission, you know?
Yeah. A lot of modeling of just really breaking binary thinking and breaking out of like boxes and actually going fuck you to all of that. Like, I am me and that's it. That's the only definition that I need to give you actually of what this is, what's happening here. Yeah.
Yeah. And it must be in the ether if Instagram's also removing the like count, you know, the fact that we can hide things like that.
I've hidden all my like counts. Oh my God. It's so good. And I feel like it's such a gift to the world to hide your like counts. Please, everybody, start hiding your like counts.
Okay. Yeah. I'll do that more. I've done it with a few posts, and it does. There is a bit of a relaxing that happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you don't have to like it, babe, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And it doesn't matter. Like, let's stop ranking each other. Let's stop willfully kind of like slotting ourselves into this ranking system, which is ultimately the root of all evil, you know, human beings being ranked above and below each other. Like, that's kind of the root of a lot of the problems in the world.
Yeah. Shit, man. Damn, now I'm like, where do we go from here, Ruby?
Listen, I would love to speak to you, since we've been touching on activism. you know, what's your definition of activism now? Like, you've worked, you've done the Morning Gloryville thing. You've also worked with Extinction Rebellion. You've worked with Black Lives Matter. Like, you really, you are a true change maker, I think. You live it, right? And you express it and you bring other people along for the ride. What's your kind of definition of activism going into, like, going post-pandemic, like, out into this brave new world?
I think that activism is dead. And I think the energy of it feels really stale to me. And I'm speaking from a place of who I am identity-wise. I don't even want to say all the things I am because I don't want to play that game anymore. It's like, to be honest, I think activism now is, it is each individual living unapologetically and really, like, asking ourselves, are we living in our most creative, expansive selves? And something's saying, there's another path. There's another path. It's like, yeah, I got asked to apply for UK Black Pride, and I'm so proud. I'm so proud of being queer. I'm so proud of being Black. I really am. I've said it so many times. But for some reason, I don't want to keep saying it now. It's like, I don't know. It's like, I don't want to use it. I don't want anyone to book me because I'm Black. And it's not that I'm not saying this from a Black privileged place. I'm not a loaded person. I'm working class, you know, but something is just like, it doesn't feel right anymore. And it's the same with climate activism. You know, I went and met up with some XR friends, and it just, you know, and I'll say this to their face as well, because I'm so honest like that. It just felt old energy. Like, I think that now is like, we've had this space to grow our inner resilience, to grow, to go within and become a bit more imaginative about how do we want our world to look. And I think now it's about us actually building those new things, you know? Mm. So for me, I mean, it's a really small thing. It's not a world-changing thing. But I was like, oh, I really want to put on a party for my friends, you know, after the pandemic. And initially, I was looking at the big clubs in London and messaging those venues. And then I was like, no, like, I don't want, that's not what I want. Like, it has to be on a beach in nature. Like, I want everyone, it has to be spacious, you know, and nourishing and different. And, you know, so I'm just like, I don't know, I guess what I'm just saying is I'm just encouraging everyone else to just be like, just pull out of the fight, just pull out of that fight energy, pull up, like the speaking up, like how, speak up, okay, yeah, speak up, but however, like, put new things into action. Like, we haven't had bombs hitting us, so it's not like a physical rebuild, but I think there's an energetic rebuild, like, that we have to do now. Like, yeah, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, make new things, like, make so many new things that there's no room for the old things. Is kind of like the visual that I'm getting, is just like a crowding out of all of the old tired crap with just this huge abundance of, like, fucking cool new stuff, basically. So this is what you've got a course which you're leading, which is kind of around this, which is about creativity and expansion. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the creative expansion course is an 8-week program that I've actually split over 3 months because I'm all about restorative living and restorative learning now. So we do 4 weeks, you know, once a week, and then we take a month off to just chill, take a step back, and then start again. Mm-hmm. But it's really for anyone who's got an idea or a project that you're working on that you want to bring out into the world that is somehow going to help people or planet, you know? Mm-hmm. And it really, you can come with no idea or an idea, but I'm creating a container that gets people to connect with, okay, what's my next version of myself? What's my next aligned action? you know, and what, you know, yeah, and what is my next mission, and what does that look like as an offering or as a personal brand or as a business, you know? Mm-hmm. So what this program does, and why I've already had 5 people sign up in the last week, is, you know, not only, you know, strategy, business strategy, but we're going to be doing like the mindset work. We're going to be bringing in, like, we're going to be learning boundaries through BDSM techniques, for example. We're going to be doing the erotic meditations that I, you know, mentioned earlier. There's going to be homework to do with nature, which will probably involve learning how to make love to trees, you know? So I'm bringing the business, my love for nature and my love for pleasure, into one program. And I don't know, I'm more humbled because I can just see how much wisdom I have on paper now. So if anything, I think, you know, it's been a massive gift to myself to just be like, oh my God, I can give, I can teach, I can officially teach. And I've got all this 12 years of experience, and like, that not many people have, like 5 years running a movement, like, you know, the years before that as an event producer, and the years after that running other projects, you know? So it's like, I feel excited. And on that note, I think it's still part of my path of activism, which is that I've realized the best way to inspire people is through art, mm-hmm. art, music, and playfulness. Which was what I did with Morning Gloryville. And I feel like I'm just coming back to that. I think I went through a bit of an angry phase in between.
<It's> okay.
yeah, I went through a bit of an angry phase.
Obviously needed to happen. Yeah. I think anyone who's listened to you on this podcast will have got a really good like taster of what to expect. And for anyone who is really ready to live unapologetically and create unapologetically in the world and make some moves, I can't imagine a better guide for them, frankly. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'll include the links for that in the show notes. Sam, this has been awesome. It's so nice to have a really proper catch up with you. I know you said you're not really that into deep conversations at the moment. Hope this was also a bit of fun. I'd love to come to your beach party in September. I don't know if quarantines will allow, but hopefully it will become a regular fixture and I'll be able to, yeah, be there another time. But thank you again for taking the time to get today. I really, really appreciate it. And thanks for sharing your story with us.
Thank you. Take care, darling. Okay.
And thank you, as always, for being here. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. And leave us a 5-star review on iTunes to help more people find this series. This podcast is edited and features original music by aloaudio.com. That's aloeaudio.com.